about being in the world and not of it. Now, I can't guarantee that I've always lived up to my understanding of that, but at least I've observed the disconnects in my life, and also as I've grown older and observed how the church works, and also how all of us affiliated with Sunstone seem to operate, I've noticed that there are disconnects in those spheres as well. I've become more and more troubled, in fact, as I've observed how what appears to be the influences of the world have permeated and infiltrated both the institutional church and what I will designate in the course of this paper as the loyal opposition. I think that creates some problems and something that we have to address and look into. In recent years, we've become more conscious of the role that myth plays in human society, thanks to Joseph Campbell and Bob Moyers, Bill Moyers, I guess it is. We understand myth a little bit more. We realize that myth is important, and that it's important because it tells us who we are and how we got here. It gives us an idea of what our beginnings were, and it anchors us in the real world. The interesting thing about all this is that for a long time, religion held a monopoly on the myth of human origin. As long as the creation story belonged to the religious worldview, it basically, fundamentally, held sway as far as the intellectual history, the philosophical history, and worldview of Western society. For a long time, religion was on top, science was on the bottom, since science started to develop the Age of Enlightenment, beginning with Galileo some of the people that followed him. Though science advanced, only an elite few dared spiritually abandon faith for science. But then came Charles Darwin. All of a sudden, science had its own creation myth. And it also had a few added advantages in that it had the fossil record as hard evidence to prove that its view of creation was perhaps more accurate than that of religions. And it could produce tangible results for anyone to examine, it was far better equipped to prevail in the struggle between science and religion. I don't intend here to discuss evolution versus religion once more. It's been done many times in the past. Darwinism is important for me here for what its introduction brought, and that is the ascendancy of the scientific model over the religious paradigm. And the scientific model took over the philosophical underpinnings of the Western world so rapidly because before Darwin it had been preparing to do this for some time. Copernicus, Galileo, Newton, Descartes, and others contributed to that revolution. And once evolution had toppled the final barrier, science began the process of supplanting religion as the underlying philosophy of the Western world. Much like silica replacing the cells of an animal that's being fossilized, the structural appearance of our philosophical structure remained, but the substance of the organism was irrevocably changed. The underpinnings of science are empiricism and positivism and various permutations of those particular philosophies. Boiled down to their bare essentials, and this is very simplistic, I admit, but it essentially captures the essence of it. These two concepts assert that for a thing or an effect to be accepted as real, it has to have observable attributes. It has to be some sort of concrete existence that can be experienced by the physical senses. It must have some sort of material reality. Hence my use of the word materialism here, perhaps a little more broader than it's often used in philosophy. Mormons often mistake the word materialism as meaning a society's obsession with the accumulation of wealth and the possessions that it can acquire. But materialism in the philosophic sense goes far beyond this narrow concept. It's really a description of existence in terms of the physical universe. Everything that can be objectively proven to exist must therefore exist. But like agnosticism, materialism argues that things that are intangible, spiritual, or metaphysical might exist, but since you can't measure or observe them, you can never be sure of their reality. So in practice, it ends up that materialists often assume just from the beginning that something that is subjective doesn't exist. Subjective experience and anecdotal evidence is rejected by materialism since it's unverifiable. Things such as paranormal abilities, supernatural events, religious experiences under materialism are deemed subjective, and therefore materialism must assume they have no reality. Sincere people who report subjective events must have experienced something, but a materialist will often attribute it to the interaction of biochemistry and brain waves. Self-awareness, extemporaneous behavior, and original thought even are regarded by extreme materialists as illusionary, being in reality just functions of researchable and definable physical interactions. Supposed spiritual or supernatural experiences are really a function of internal brain chemistry influenced by environmental determinants. Of course, the reason why science has been so successful in overturning the religious worldview is that it tends to work. We see it actually functioning. We see it accomplish things. When a witch doctor's potion fails to cure appendicitis, modern surgery can guarantee recovery. And our culture has so often encountered the inadequacy of the old paradigm in explaining manipulating the natural world and had so much success with science that we've all but jettisoned the old ways and embraced wholesale the new. And the impact of that, of materialism on the thought processes of our society, are profound. One evidence of this is our society's critical approach to everything. Evidence must be evaluated, credibility established, and a chain of responsibility created. Rampant skepticism is an unavoidable result. Assertions made, conclusions drawn, opinions expressed must all be subjected to and approved by a rigorous evaluation process. Claims about phenomena or experiences that are scientifically irrational are automatically presumed to be false or naive until evidence proves otherwise, but since rational science makes the rules, acceptable proof seldom, if ever, materializes. This can be helpful, of course, because it helps us discard faulty theories, faulty conclusions, and faulty beliefs. But because things such as the nature of God or the reality of an afterlife or the existence of the soul have eluded so far any attempt at mathematical analysis or physical measurement, they are empirically unknowable, and materialism's consequent mistrust of anything metaphysical has become a hallmark of our culture's underlying bias. Since prayer, visions, divine visitations, prophecy all involve subjective knowledge, they can't provide any acceptable confirmation of any sort of metaphysical reality. As Spinoza said, supernatural revelation is not reliable, since if man is not capable of discovering a truth for himself, he is also not capable of discovering whether it is truth. Since scientists must have a scientifically acceptable explanation for everything, Joseph Smith, Muhammad, and other religious figures who claimed visions of revelation are often alleged by materialists to have suffered epileptic episodes, based on no other evidence than that they have professed to have had these visitations. Religious dogmas have been discredited by scientific investigation, been changed to accommodate more modern perspectives, or appear increasingly untenable when measured against empirical yardsticks of what seemed to be possible and what is apparently impossible in the physical universe. Consequently, today's decline of formalized religious practice is at least partly and perhaps wholly behind the declining belief in the relevance of religious form and ritual. Increasingly, religious practices are seen as empty traditions that bear little relevance to a person's daily life or the real world. A further manifestation of the materialist worldview is the trend towards a value-free society. With the coming of the scientific age, absolutes have disappeared. Qualities such as blue, hard, round, or hot can be empirically demonstrated. However, you cannot empirically prove values such as beautiful, noble, or good. As philosopher Leszek Kolakowski suggests, we can prove that an antibiotic will defeat a disease and save a person, but we cannot prove the principle that human life is an irreplaceable value. While we are entitled to express value judgments, we are not entitled to assume that our grounds for making them are scientific, but only rather that our grounds for making them are our own arbitrary choices. Of course, consequently, we come to the values crisis that so many on the Christian right have condemned. If moral qualities and subjective values can't be verified, and if empirical verification is essential for us to accept something as real, moral absolutes not only cease to be binding, but cease to exist. Secular attempts to say that any particular behavior is inherently good or bad, founded on the question, what evidence is there that your opinion is any better than mine? The West's value systems may finally rest on nothing more solid than fleeting public consensus, suggesting something Chauncey Riddle once said, there's no such thing as evidence apart from a matrix of presuppositions. Objectivity is at best consensus, and consensus is often but a public relations job. In a recently published book, Brian Appleyard describes the situation similarly. Seeing man as an accident of the cosmos, science is spiritually corrosive, burning away ancient authorities and traditions. There is only relative rightness or wrongness. There is no absolute form of either. Science does not tell us why we should do things or how we should live. It offers instead solutions and is perfectly capable of marginalizing believers without actually stripping them of their beliefs. So far, I've talked about science as if I completely, you know, science and materialist worldview as if I was completely opposed to them. That's not actually the case. I wouldn't want to reject any of the principles that system actually espouses. Scientific thinking can be a powerful tool in the quest for truth. And even my paper makes use of some of the conventions and assumptions that are part of the empirical method. Critical thinking is valuable, and skepticism is often the appropriate approach to unverified claims. There are, after all, philosophies, religious views, and superstitious hoaxes that need to be investigated, exposed, and rejected, some perhaps even within Mormonism. One should never blindly accept someone's claim to revelation, supernatural guidance, or supposed wisdom from beyond, not even Joseph Smith's. The ongoing questioning of values has also been immensely useful to society. Without the development of modern perspectives, many intolerant beliefs and biased practices would never have been discredited. Many civil rights would never have been guaranteed. Since empirical research can prove that there are no differences between races that can justify prejudicial treatment, our society has advanced considerably in how it treats individuals. Even the American Constitution owes its beginnings to the rationalism of the Enlightenment. However, the problem arises when empiricism and the scientific method are taken too far. They become ends in themselves. They become, in effect, a religion in their own right. Scientism is the word Appleyard, among others, uses. As William Hurt declared once, Christianity is screwed up. Our representative religion in Western culture is physics. Scientific experts are regarded with awe and rendered due obeisance. Experimental results are greeted by the rank and file as if they had the authority of Holy Writ and are accepted with the same credulity that was once reserved for religion. We forget that the principles underlying the materialist worldview are merely valuable tools rather than the philosophical consummation of our universe as they are often treated. Said Manly P. Hall, the 20th century makes a fetish of civilization and is overwhelmed by its own fabrications. Its gods are of its own making. Materialism makes its basic mistake in presuming that nothing exists outside what can be directly experienced by human senses and the tools designed to augment them. Verification is the only scientific criterion of reality, writes John Fowles in The Magus. That does not mean that there may not be realities that are unverifiable. By refusing to accept the possibility that metaphysical realms and experiences can exist, materialism is in danger of ignoring a major and perhaps even the major element of the universe. So what about Mormonism and materialism? The basic question is, what does this all have to do with the church? Before we answer that, we have to consider one interesting paradox, and that is that Mormonism itself may be the ultimate expression of materialism. Joseph Smith's revelation in the DNC that there is no such thing as immaterial matter, all spirit is matter, but fine and pure, suggests that everything, even spirit, has some sort of physical existence. Then again, maybe matter isn't what we think it is at all, in light of the doctrinal idea that everything, even the temporal, is really spiritual. There's some interesting correlations with modern physics theories that suggest that only energy exists. What we know of as matter is really only frozen energy. In a certain sense, Mormon doctrine tells us that we are always in one sort of material existence or another. We start out in the refined matter spiritual state, you know, the pre-existence, and then we become physical bodies, and then we die and become refined matter again, and then we're resurrected as some sort of physical body. It's a continuing string of physical incarnations of some sort. If there's any more after that, we haven't been told. We haven't got that far. I guess, thank goodness, I don't know. Mormonism teaches further that God is himself a subject to law. If he breaks these laws, he would cease to be God. Because of his greater knowledge of natural principles, he can supersede restrictions that natural law places or seems to place and perform what we call miracles. Miracles are therefore not a violation of natural law, but instead follow rules which we don't as yet understand. It's much the same way that we get around gravity by putting wings on airplanes and using the laws of thermodynamics to get us up in the air. Brigham Young's statement that there are no miracles only to those who are ignorant finds resonance with Arthur C. Clarke's famous dictum, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Mormonism even teaches a modified form of the scientific method. In Alma 32, where he tells us how to experiment to find our faith, he even uses the word experiment. You take the premise that faith may exist, then you test it, and if it doesn't work, you prove Elmer wrong. If it does work, then you discover that that he was correct. The formula for finding out the truth of the Book of Mormon suggested in Moroni 10:4 follows essentially that same format. And we're not talking about empirical experiments in the accepted sense, but they do follow the same logic structure and concept. If we assume that Mormon doctrine is correct and that Mormonism represents some sort of enlightened or paradoxically metaphysical materialism, then what is the difficulty with materialism that permeates Western society today? It's because of our culture, secular materialist philosophy is a truncated travesty, a corrupted usurper of the enlightened materialism embodied in the gospel. The great misfortune is that many Mormons, with all the access they have available to a higher form, have settled in such an alarming degree for the lower form of materialism. And this is demonstrated in several ways. First is the redefinition of the priesthood in administrative terms. When Joseph Smith and other church leaders spoke of the power of the priesthood, they meant literal power. Ordination of the priesthood through the laying on of hands was just an outward symbol of a profound and very real endowment of spiritual power that was invested unseen upon the one so ordained. That was the same power that had changed water to fine wine Christ had used, that it has moved entire mountains at the utterance of proper keywords or caused blind eyes to again send messages to the brain. The performance of the ordinances was in the priesthood, but was merely the mystical formulas that unlocked the real power in the same way an American president cipher opens a silo and launches an ICBM. Of course, many in the modern church have lost sight of this concept. Priesthood has come to be equated with temporal affairs, chain of command, spheres of administrative authority, and organizational obedience. We have diluted, even cheapened, the early concepts of priesthood. Today, the priesthood sets up the chairs in the cultural hall. The priesthood attends general priesthood meetings and is rewarded with ice cream for doing so. Priesthood holders are comfortable performing safe ordinances like blessing the children or performing baptisms, confirmations, and the like. But there's an uneasiness, even reluctance to perform blessings for the sick and other such functions where the true nature of the priesthood power would be revealed and required. Certainly the reluctance isn't universal, but it still is there. As a whole, it seems that this reluctance is growing and that materialist contamination is responsible. Materialism works its wiles in a variety of ways. It brings us to question the usefulness of relying on a religious procedure that is empirically unverifiable, that functions through some mechanism that's unseeable, unmeasurable, and undiscoverable by rational intellects and the logic systems that we have created with them. Since science has boasted that it has often in the past proven claims of supernatural events or practices to be false or ineffective, we may inwardly wonder if we are wrong to trust something as arcane as the laying on of hands. Our confidence in our priesthood power is shaken. We prefer to avoid situations where we might have employed priesthood ordinances, and when we do perform them, we load them with conditional phrases and noncommittal language. This is not something of which we are conscious, but rather an attitude or mindset we have absorbed from our cultural environment. We have allowed science to become a crutch to us, the arm of flesh pumped up on the steroids of the empirical method. We often, for example, regard modern medicine with the same uncritical awe pagans reserve for Astarte or the gods of Olympus. And part of that's understandable. We've seen medicine work. We've seen it cure people, people who are close to us in many cases. And it's accomplished other things that lure us into its fold. If we hear a voice in our home when no one but ourselves are present, we don't immediately assume it is a message from God. We look instead to see if the clock radio has turned itself on or if the answering machine is recording a message. And if we want to go from one end of the continent to the other in a short time without ever touching the ground, we catch a nonstop flight from Dulles. These things are all visible or verifiable by us. We've grown comfortable with controllable miracles. We know they work, and if they don't, we can find out why. And so we learn the habits of thinking in terms of technology, and including its limits, which, because we get used to them, are invisible, these limits are. If something isn't doable by technology, it automatically becomes impossible. Because of these ingrained ways of thinking, many Mormons increasingly become uncomfortable with spiritual manifestations. Think how you felt the last time someone related a striking spiritual experience in fast meeting. Did you try to imagine how it might have been or long to experience something similar? Or did you start thinking about how it was explainable as a rare coincidence or cast about in your mind for a more probable cause and effect relationship? Did you question perhaps the reliability of the person relating it? Further, there's an inclination to subtly suppress the still small voice, or anything that goes beyond this subtle subtleties of the still small voice. One is reminded of Elder Pullman's general conference talk, where too much discussion of free agency and personal revelation was apparently regarded as objectionable by someone in the hierarchy. What discussions are of personal revelation are often quite abstract and focus primarily on how the Holy Ghost helps us know right from wrong. The institutional church itself may be somewhat responsible for this. It's developed a certain paranoia as far as situations like this, revelation by the members, perhaps because of situations where Hiram Page, similar to where Hiram Page found his own seer stone, he began receiving revelations for the whole church. You know, there's justification for the paranoia, you know, obviously because of the many problems with Mormon fundamentalists and splinter groups and all kinds of stuff going on, Irvel LeBaron and Jeff Lundgren and their followers, etc. The question is, though, is it worth suppressing valid spiritual epiphanies for fear of the counterfeit? Materialism has also made its inroads into the missionary attitudes of church members. We're told every member is a missionary, yet many find it personally difficult to fulfill those expectations. One cause of this is normal reticence, someone to draw attention to themselves and are uncomfortable confronting people. But there's another factor here, too. Sometimes we've assimilated too much of the materialist view of relative truth. Consider this. If we accept the gospel as taught by the LDS Church to be true, then we must also accept the implication that there are widely held beliefs present in the world and espoused by many people that are categorically false. Yet because many of us succumb to the materialist attitude that no absolutes exist to allow one to judge who is right and who is not, we are reluctant to tell people, even in the gentlest of terms, that they are wrong. So much for crying repentance to the world. In consequence of everything I've said thus far, it seems that church members are less expectant of encountering spiritual events and more reluctant to trust the Spirit. In fact, if you were to ask an average Latter-day Saint, which I've done on several occasions, how one recognized inspiration or revelation, it's very likely they would say, I don't know. They don't know themselves how that works. The uniform corporate consistency of the church hierarchy may play a role here. Today we no longer expect overt public revelations, just as such as were anticipated in Joseph Smith's day. I believe that the prophet and apostles truly do receive revelation in supporting their guidance to us as members. But it's often couched so much in terms of advice and counsel, which in our proper balance are good, that it's difficult to separate hard revelation from correlated organizational efficiency and positive mental platitudes. As a substitute for spiritual meat, we become over-reliant on structural milk. Structure provides comfort, but carried to far hierarchies and rules can stifle spiritual growth. There's a certain unpredictability in spiritual development, and not only can such development not well survive an obsession with image and conformity, but its process makes those who are so obsessed extremely uncomfortable. A reluctance to trust the members reflects a certain materialist fear of losing control, of having ragged threads pop up at the edges to mar the simple elegance of the church's controlled experiment. Emotions increasingly substitute for epiphany, sentimentality counterfeits true spirituality. Another thing that struck me recently is the disappearance from discussion of many of the more unusual doctrines of the church. It's almost as if there has been a conscious suppression of a number of doctrines that would be awkwardly received in modern materialist society. Things like the law of adoption, the blood of Christ, Christ's marriage, the nature of celestial bodies, among many others that you could probably think of yourselves. They've not been denied or rescinded, but we don't talk about them. Try and find them anywhere in the manuals of priesthood or relief society, or even in what I call the egregiously misnamed gospel doctrine class. One understands that such teachings may be inappropriate for missionaries or new member discussions, as well as in the gospel essentials class, which is now called the gospel principles class. Where are we going to learn them, though? Few people read Marvelous Work and a Wonder anymore, and there has not been an adequate, popularly accessible doctrinal treatment published since. There's more involved here, too. I think I'm going to skip this part. It has to do with image-making in the church. The main points, though, are that I think we're too much concerned with looking like everybody else. We're too much concerned with our image. Image is important if we're going to be a missionary church, but when it gets to the point that it is now, it's almost as if the image is defining us rather than us defining the image, as it ought to be. But this also reflects a further danger, which is the natural impulse to belong. Assimilation is a threat to the church. Our children want to be popular among their peers, and we want to be popular in our circles as well. So we adopt the camouflage and many of the materialist attitudes that permeate our culture. The church itself wants to be more widely respected, so it tries to adopt a more conventional appearance. Some of this is behavior is appropriate, but carried too far can throw us off balance and make us vulnerable to materialist enticings. Now, all of I've said before might be interpreted that I'm criticizing the church or the leaders. I'm not really doing that. Even in the inspired church, or perhaps even especially there, we are all reflections of each other. Leaders were once part of the spiritual proletariat, and despite charges to the contrary, church leaders do hear and respond to members' needs and complaints. And don't do it all the time. And sometimes it takes them a long time to get around to it, but it happens more often than not, though sometimes the response is not what we would prefer to hear necessarily. But of course, whether we're a leader or an average member of the church, we're all products not only of the kingdom of God, but also of our own society. We can't help but have our attitudes and philosophies colored by the world around us. Awareness of the nature of our cultural biases, however, is a first giant leap towards correcting the distortions which have, for the most part, crept in unawares. Now, I'm done with the institutional church. Now I'm going to lambaste the loyal opposition. And by loyal opposition, I couldn't think of a better word. I came up with all kinds of things, and none of them worked, so I was resorted to this. I'm talking about, you know, Sunstoners, you know, people who read Dialogue and Exponent 2 and who come to Sunstone Symposia and who, you know, mutter and gripe in the background about things, you know. That's who I'm talking about. And, of course, I'm going to speak in generalities. A lot of what I say won't fit all of you or even most of you. I should say us, because I fit in here, too. Some will be able to come up with counters to my stereotypes and whatever, but of course I have to do it anyway, right, for the sake of the paper. But as Mark Twain said, no generalization is worth a damn, not even this one. So, much of the difficulties experienced by members of the loyal opposition with the church are directly related to the materialist worldview, in which they've been steeped throughout their lives. It's no accident that greater levels of education and more of an emphasis on intellectuality prevail among the loyal opposition than in other large populations in the institutional LDS church. The highly educated have all the more profoundly absorbed the elixirs of materialism. Often the doubts, disenchantments, and complaints suffered by the loyal opposition are shared only with one or a few friends of like mind. However, through various underground publications, such as Dialogue and Sunstone, and during such symposia as this, these thoughts and theories can be vented. It's therefore in such venues that the profoundly materialistic orientation of the loyal opposition is most apparent, and it's manifest in a number of ways. Most prominent is the nearly exclusive reliance on critical reasoning and liberal skepticism to evaluate Mormon issues. Empiricism pervades the papers and discussions that occur here. Since, as I discussed above, empirical reasoning can be a valuable tool for arriving at truth, it's not necessarily bad. But much other materialist baggage comes along with it. It seems, for example, that one may not presume that such a thing as revelation exists. In fact, one often finds the typical materialist mistrust of revelation per se. Everything related to the church must be defined in terms of social trajectories and secular cause and effect relationships. This is especially true of historical explorations. Often the events of yesterday are defined, evaluated, and judged in terms of the perspectives and theories in vogue in today's scholarly circles. Certainly, secular tools can help us more fully understand what happened in our past. Just as certainly, environmental factors in the physical world do exert dramatic influence on unfolding history. Unfortunately, too many of these studies are oblivious to the possibility that supernatural forces might be at work as well. True, there is no place in empiricism for such consideration, but in a forum that focuses ostensibly on Mormonism, one would think the possibility might at least be acknowledged. And there is often a tacit and unquestioned assumption that environment is the only force, environment and genetics, are the only forces that can adequately explain why people turn out to be the way they do, ignoring the implications of eternally existent personalities and the influences of supernatural sources of evil and good. When discussed at all, God and Satan is almost never discussed, is often referred to in terms that partake more of the distant, uncreated, insubstantial, unknowable, Trinitarian concept of a conventional Christianity that has been gutted by existentialism and rendered toothless by the triumph of scientism. This leads in turn to adoption of liberal Protestant attitudes about things religious, under the misapprehension that this is the only alternative to the iron rod, closed-mindedness of conservative Mormons. Where the institutional church often mistakes sentimentality for spirituality, the loyal opposition sometimes confuses true spirituality with the contemplative life of conventional Christian thinkers and mystics. Contemporary politically correct rhetoric and current wisdom frequently are preferred over scriptural reference and more normative pronouncements of church leaders past and present. Indeed, in another of the many unspoken assumptions, general authorities often are automatically suspected of being wrong should they disagree with the current version of the received wisdom. You know. There is a searching or preference for materialist explanations for miracles and supernatural events. Little awareness of the notorious fickleness of scientific trends and theories is expressed. Religion is defined along secular lines. More active understanding of the term religion. While Mormonism has a broader, more active understanding of the term religion, conventional Christianity has more passive, narrower definition of the word, including such concepts essentially foreign to Mormonism as the fundamental depravity of man, the ineffability and ultimate unapproachability of God, the unresolved mystery of man's existence, the ascendancy of grace. Regrettably, when one attempts to fit Mormonism into liberal Protestant philosophy and theology, one must often cut off the feet to match the bed. You probably all got counterexamples to the things I've listed here, and we certainly wouldn't want Sunstone to become just like one more state conference, nor would we want the dialogue to sound and look like the Ensign. The loyal opposition, together with the fora and publications through which it makes itself heard, has provided far more that is positive than negative. Just the fact that there's a place where we can talk about things is extremely valuable. The problem is that because of the materialist worldview, the advertised full spectrum of Mormonism is not yet fully being heard here. A quick thing on solutions here. Materialism, of course, is suffering some ravages because of quantum physics and chaos theory and things like that, newer developments in science. Nonetheless, both disciplines and our worldview still are pretty much influenced by empirical reasoning. The early leaders of the church were convinced that one day when all about religion, everything about religion was known and everything about science was known, we'd have true religion and true science, and they'd fit together into one eternal round. It seems, however, today, in the current ongoing battle between religion and empiricism, that many members of the church have abandoned the hope that of the unification of those two areas. This is all perhaps further indication that we have lost sight of where we ought to be. The answer lies neither in conventional scientific nor conventional thinking, but rather, emulating both Joseph Smith and Jesus Christ, in going beyond the hidebound mental constructs of our customary social and religious culture. Let science fulfill its mandate of teaching us about the physical universe and deflating the fevered imaginations of two gullible metaphysicians and religionists. And let true spirituality fulfill its responsibility of re-educating those steeped in scientific hubris and pomposity. We cannot afford to have science continue to go beyond its mandate and become, as a substitute for organized religion, the purveyor of absolutes. There is absolutely no spiritual existence. There is absolutely no supreme being. At the same time, we can even less afford to allow spirituality and true religion to be seduced by the materialist worldview and force us to live in a relativist, purposeless morass, accidents of the universe without moral rudder, denying our own spiritual longings. As Hugh Nebley tells us, Schopenhauer once observed that the two most serious defects of Christian teaching are the denial of spirits to all creatures but man and to life for all worlds but this one. These closely related doctrines have formed the common ground on which fundamentalism and scientism have joined hands. The former horrified at the thought of being related to lower creatures than man, the latter scorning any suggestion that he might be related to higher ones. Where science and religion are not yet reconciled, but materialism has presented us with a false dichotomy. There is, in reality, no need to abandon one for the other. It is necessary to learn how to hold judgment in abeyance, not concluding with each latest scientific pronouncement that it surely spells the end of our faith. There will always be new theories and new discoveries that cast today's sometimes precipitous conclusions in different light. We must stop allowing materialists to convince us that the supernatural does not exist, force us to feel apologetic or uncomfortable for believing in and accepting spiritual things. At the same time, we must take full advantage of empirical tools to help anchor ourselves in the physical world. This means, in effect, that we must transcend the prejudices and rigid thinking of our limiting worldviews and replace them with an open mind and a ravening hunger for additional light and knowledge. Thank you.
I am pleased to be here today to talk about Mormon ideas, and it has certainly been an interesting experience to sort through the many notions that Mr. Smith has presented for us here today. I hope to outline, however briefly, some areas of disagreement and concurrence that Paul and I share. First, let me talk about those remarks of Paul with which I agree. They are fewer in number than our disagreements. Paul is certainly correct when he observes that the priesthood had become nearly coextensive with the temporal administration of the church. I, too, am puzzled why the most common and public examples of priesthood authority are seen when it is time to organize meetings, or call irascible deacons to set up chairs for state conference, or establish ward softball leagues and dinners at the start of priesthood meetings, ostensibly dedicated to learning about the gospel. Only too rarely do we participate in the higher level theological rituals, calling on the name of God to heal a comatose child, or to preserve the life of an unborn infant, or plead with God for the end of suffering in this wretched world. Any reading of 19th century Mormon diaries portrays the central role that the priesthood played in calling upon God to deal with the exigencies of their everyday lives. Those were times of great need, and the simple, but not the simplistic, faith of the early saints cannot be missed. Now, however, the priesthood is used to call upon God to help guide the deliberations of self-serving public officials, or to solve minor neighborhood disputes, or to adjudicate family disagreements over a furniture purchase, or to provide assistance in finding the car keys. Paul is right when he observes that perhaps the priesthood is too commonly used for relatively minor matters, and may have lost too much of its emotional and spiritual force. As society has become more secular, its role and need for the more extraordinary aspects of the priesthood has diminished. Like the child fleeing its innocence and its need of the extraordinary help of its parents, we seem to have moved away from the direct invocation of the power of God. Where the priesthood once moved mountains, it now moves chairs. If this is the thrust of Paul's paper, then I agree, and we should all mourn the effects of the modern age. But Paul has not shown the link between his criticism of contemporary LDS administration and the materialist bent of Mormon theology. Thus my agreement with Paul now ends, introducing us to what I consider to be some errors in his presentation. Recently, traditional Mormon philosophy has come under nearly constant attack from several groups who have argued, among other things, that there is something essentially unsophisticated and unwashed about historic Mormon claims concerning the tangible reality of a corporeal God who observes law. With that has come the open suspicion that human beings are inherently corrupt, thus rendering human efforts at knowledge less than adequate to the life of faith. A part of that effort has been the advocacy of the idea that philosophical materialism, which plays a central role in Mormon philosophy, is a primary area of weakness in LDS theology. A recent effort in this direction, but not by far the worst, I'm happy to say, is Paul's attempt here today to convince us that Mormon materialism is flawed for any one or more of the arguments that he advances. I believe, as I've said, that Paul is mistaken, for many reasons, among which are, first, Paul spends some time in attempting to impale positivism, by which he takes to mean the unshakable assistance that if some proposition cannot be immediately proved, or if some previous claim about the world cannot be repeated, then the claim must be false. Given the vagaries of the scientific method, including the imprecision in the experimental model currently introduced by quantum mechanics and chaos theory, it is not clear to me why so-called hard positivism, is held up as the only configuration of the scientific method which Paul then sets about to impugn. I don't think it is as easy as all that. It might be helpful here to very briefly review one small area of Mormon claims. One of the most defensible and delightful aspects of the LDS theology is its unflappable insistence upon the material existence of all things. In fact, Mormonism treats as absurd the notion that something can exist and yet have no physical component. It is this peculiar philosophical materialism mixed in with the claims about God's literal physical existence which drops or should drop the mantle of intellectual discipline over religious claims in the Mormon context. If an advocate of a theological proposition is required to show that some idea can be demonstrated by reference to tangible proof, or at least argue that such a claim is capable of being demonstrated, even if not immediately, then wild flights of fancy into all sorts of quasi-religious claims, popular in these days of feel-good New Age anarchy, are effectively prohibited. If a proponent of any particular notion cannot advance a decent argument for the possible reality of that claim, or fails in her efforts to show that some religious claim is actually true, then the response is not to impale such standards of proof, as Paul seems to suggest, but to point out that there might be something wrong with the claim. I believe that Paul makes a mistake when he poses individual experience against the notion of philosophical materialism, which only requires that the proponent of any proposition move beyond merely anecdotal status. That does not mean, however, that anecdotal reports per se cannot have a verifiable component. There are many ways of demonstrating a proposition. Even the most passionate, hard positivist would not deny that the intangible notion of love has observable components in the everyday world. Materialism is not impugned because some claims are not reproducible at will in a laboratory. Mormon materialism merely holds that claims concerning all sentient beings, gods and humanity alike, are subject to the test of experience and law. Mormonism has no place for the ramblings of soothsayers and otherworldly savants, instead preferring the responsible control over assertion which its materialist philosophy requires. Without that discipline, every claim, no matter how remarkable or astonishing, would be accorded equal deference. On to another disagreement. In my view, behaviorism is not the natural outgrowth of philosophical materialism, and certainly cannot trace its genesis to Mormon materialism, which is enlightened by its unique view of the physical reality of God. Mormonism has always insisted that the soul has a physical reality which permits it to survive its experiences. Now, how that invokes the Skinnerian horrors that Paul recounts in another version of his paper is unclear. When science finally catalogs the mind, which I think Paul fears will be the death of religion, I believe it will find the soul or evidence of it. Paul has not shown how the notion of a material soul is antithetical to moral reasoning or to a belief in God. Another point. While some might assert that anyone reporting religious experiences, whether by Joseph Smith or Muhammad or others, suffered from a neurological event which can best be understood in chemical or electrical terms, Paul too easily concludes that any claim made by religious persons cannot be verified in material terms. It is unclear to me why Paul so easily concedes the point that spiritual and religious claims are immune from any species of material proof. Time and again, Paul speaks of religious people, quote, holding the line against science, close quote, as if science and religious sentiment will always be at war with one another. That perspective is foreign to the Mormon experience and calls into question many of the strengths of the LDS theology. That point is made more clear by recalling again the importance of Mormon materialism with which Paul is apparently uneasy. In the case of Smith's experience, he either spoke to heavenly messengers or he didn't. If he didn't speak with the material God, then he was either a liar or he was nuts. On the other hand, if his claims represented the literal truth of that situation, then I celebrate the idea that Smith conversed with a deity that actually exists. That is certainly preferable to the Aquinian God, who has no concern for the material world, which does not move him, and which world should have no concern about the existence of such an ineffable deity. Mormonism shares with William James the idea of a partnership between suffering humanity and a literally real God who participates in the human experience. Such an idea of God is capable, at some point at least, in principle, of being demonstrated. Therefore, Mormon philosophical materialism can provide to the LDS faithful a genuine way of understanding God. I am astonished at the connection Paul tries to make between materialism and a modern culture that he assesses as being value-free. It is a crystal clear tenet of Mormon philosophy that moral injunctions have a tangible referent. When a young woman's leader advocates sexual abstinence before marriage and fidelity after, she is saying more than merely expressing an inchoate sentiment that sexual pleasure is improper in certain settings. Rather, she is making a much stronger claim, namely the emotion of human beings is injured and the ability to bond to an eternal companion is called into question when intimate sexual activity is divorced from a transcendent commitment. Similar arguments can be advanced in a tangible way concerning other areas of Mormon moral reasoning. Mormon theology and moral standards do not exist in a chaotic world where mere assertion defines the nature of things. In LDS thought, neither God nor humanity create the structure of laws. Rather, we are all called upon to obey law. Philosophical materialism supports, rather than denigrates, the Mormon concept of moral injunction and instruction. It does not injure it. With that background, it remains unclear to me why Paul so quickly walks away from the defensible position that in the Mormon context, moral injunctions are based upon genuine, real-world considerations. One might disagree with those reasons, but Mormonism at least advocates the idea that moral rules are derived from experience and natural law, rather than the other way around. If science is seen by some to have burned away ancient authorities and religious traditions, then the appropriate response is to ask whether those traditions can be defended in the strictly Mormon sense, or to ask whether science has interpreted has made a mistake. In conclusion, philosophical materialism needs to be more carefully defined and explored to adequately understand its implications for theology. In particular, Mormonism's contribution to the discussion of materialism provides much of the strength that is inherent in the LDS system. Therefore, it is odd when a central pillar of Mormon theology is questioned on the grounds that so-called supernatural events cannot be considered within that framework. To the contrary, any theology based upon an ultimately unprovable deity, in front of which ignorant humankind debases itself in mystery, is unworthy of consideration. Too little exploration of Mormon theology has been done, and most of what passes for that discussion has been incomplete. Thank you.
We now have 10 minutes for the two presenters to entertain questions from the audience.
I think that's a good observation on how you actually might say it's the difference between Hell's Law perceived in Mormon theology versus, you know, secular science. In science, law is descriptive. What happens all the time, what happens all the time unless it's proven false, you know, unless you come up with a counterexample. As opposed to in Mormonism, law is what determines what everybody does and determines how the universe works. It's a determinant thing as opposed to a descriptive thing. I don't know other than that. It's just one more thing that separates those two worldviews. I'm not going to get into my rebuttal of Mark at this point because we're into the question and answer, but do you want to say something about this?
At least my reading of Mormon theology says to me that prescriptive law flows out of descriptive law, not the other way around. Because if it were the other way around, there would be no control over assertion, and God could say, as we could, anything we pleased and have it true. When we speak, as I tried to point out, however imperfectly, when we speak of moral injunction, those things are, in lawyer terms, a codification of a greater law. That is, we stop for lights because if you don't, the laws of physics will take over and you or others will be injured. I see Mormon moral injunctions, which are prescriptive in nature, or ought to be at least, flowing out of the background of descriptive law. For that reason, I'm uncomfortable about the dichotomy that Paul and others draw sometimes between, and the wedge they try to shove between descriptive and prescriptive law. I see Mormonism as encompassing all law and pulling it into a round, a unified theory of morality, if you will, rather than trying to draw that distinction. One flows from the other and is not divorced from the other. Because I think it's easier to order people than convince them. I mean, it's a lot easier. I teach the 18-year-olds in my ward, and it's a lot easier simply to tell them to walk into class and fall asleep and obey and walk out the door. It's a lot tougher to convince another mind. And I simply think that the path of greater resistance is the gentle persuasion Scripture speaks of. It's a lot easier just to figuratively kick the backsides of Mormons and get them to fall into line. I prefer the former to the latter.
I'm going to use that quote. That's really good. I think part of the problem, too, is the fact that basically the church at large is unaware of that economy. And I think I'm going to have to do some rebuttal here to Mark. Otherwise, we're going to have a confusion perpetrated here. Basically, he and I agree on this thing completely. The results here we see of trying to cram, you know, what should be, you know, an hour and a half into 30 minutes and not having a blackboard for me to draw this out, because that's normally, when I teach a class, I have to have a blackboard because then I can show the relationship. I'm kind of a spatial sort of a guy. For your sake, Mark, I'm presuming that just my confusion of address here confused you, but I don't disagree with the idea that Mormon materialism is the right worldview to adopt. But I call it enlightened materialism, and the dichotomy I'm trying to set up here is between the secular materialist perception of the world and Mormon doctrine. And I'm saying that we have been influenced, we've absorbed the secular perception of materialism, which is an inferior variety. And I'm not talking, I talk about science, I talk about empiricism because that's the origin of it. But in reality, when I talk about this whole secular approach to materialism, I'm talking about the whole society. And I'm talking about the rank and file of society who have taken some of the lessons of science and some of the philosophies of science and taken them to a logical extreme and therefore order their lives and their philosophies after that. They've come to the point where they reject reject, you know, spiritual manifestations. They reject miraculous, supposedly miraculous sort of things because they've been taught to reject that basically by science until it's been evaluated, but they forget the evaluation part. My prime person and my prime scoundrel in all this is Carl Sagan. I think that he's done a lot of damage to the whole concept of spirituality because he insists on defining everything on materialist cause and effect, and he denies out of hand any particular sort of spiritual impact on our lot in our daily lives in the world, in the real world. If you'll read the things that he writes, you see that he starts out with the assumption that can't be true, and then he finds reasons to explain why he believes it isn't true, rather than evaluating the thing in and of itself and coming up, you know, with whatever possible criteria there are to evaluate whether it really is true or not. So we don't disagree, we just misapprehend each other here, Mark.
Oh, I don't know, Paul. I think we disagree. Respectfully, I think the problem with these issues that you identify is not the presence of materialism, but the absence of it. I think that to the extent that we have adopted, popular culture has adopted notions where we ignore what you call supernatural events, which I call quite natural, is because we have, the Western Christian culture has adopted the idea that God is unknowable, immaterial, ineffable, unapproachable, and cannot be approached by the human mind. It is rather Smith's perspective that God is tangible, you can go up and touch him, talk with him, wrestle with him, according to the book of Abraham and so forth, that would inform rather than depreciate the experiences I think that Paul is discussing. I want to advocate more strongly a notion of strict, hard materialism in the universe, because in that way we can control assertion, we can come up with ways of understanding the universe in more tangible and transmittable ways, and avoid the social fallout that Paul is speaking about. He and I agree with the fallout, but it's just that his reasons are wrong.
Would you continue saying a few words about the predicate to all of this? Both of you are talking about a system, and then you're disagreeing, but I'm not hearing. I'd like to hear where this first principle is.
Well, I don't know about Paul's, but I guess my first principle is the belief in the tangible reality of deities, the gods, and other people around us, you and I, the interaction of human minds, all of which exist in the tangible, definable, law-governed universe. That's my faith. That is the way in which God speaks to me and I speak to him. He does more listening than I do sometimes, but it is that central pillar that I base things on. I reject Christian scholasticism, which says you can sit around in some dark room and think about the world and then go out and find some interpretation of the same, which fits that predisposition. I think, like Smith, you go out and find the world, you understand it, and after you've understood, in some sense, the outline of it, then you come up with laws or reasons to integrate it all. The other way around, we end up being nothing but Aquinian scholastics, and that screwed up Western civilization for a long time.
Yeah, see, Smith's story talks about his seeing didn't happen, and then we go home.
I think this, something like that may be true. If we were to walk up to a Catholic and a Mormon on the street and say, do you believe in God, the answer phenomenologically would be the same, but the referent is quite different. My faith comes from the assumption, frankly, that the universe is knowable, definable, observable, quite tangible, and God and humanity play a role in and are a necessary part of that experience. What I've tried to do, however imperfectly, is to avoid setting up constructs which are independent of experience and then imposing those on what happens to me and others. I prefer the more tangible approach that Smith said. Look, Smith had no theology until he was visited. His theology was derived out of of what I believe to have been a tangible interaction with the material God, who said, look, all the rest of these guys don't have it right, and here's what's right. Now go off and create a theology around that. That's my own faith. And to the extent that there is tension or militations against that, then I think whatever we end up having, it probably is not genuine Mormonism.
Of course, Mormonism is predicated on the concept that there is a master plan that determines whether this world is supposed to go on or not. And in fact, that's the whole basis of the thing. Everything is structured and organized at the God level. You know, he knows what's going to happen. He knows how it's supposed to happen. There are some intrinsic uncertainties there. Perhaps that's chaos theory working in the celestial kingdom. I don't know. But
I don't think that to be really what more the gods and themselves are themselves having to partake of.
Well, I think you hit on...
So the God knows answer, doesn't really
Yeah.
Know it.
Well, you've hit on the ultimate, asking the ultimate question why. You know, you ask it enough times and you're going to come to a point where you don't get an answer. And actually, Mormonism pushes that threshold back a ways further than most conventional Christianity. But you do reach a point where there is no answer to why. I mean, we have the postulate that God is subjected to law, that is subject to law, that matter is eternal, as is the human personality, and God himself. But we're all at just different stages. But the question is, where did that law come from and where did that matter come from? And the answer may be that it never came from anywhere, which is a concept that we as finite individuals can't grasp here. Maybe that's what it means to become like God. At some point we'll be able to grasp this concept of infinity. But
I think infinity is a good place to stop, do you think? Thank you all for coming today and enjoy the rest of your sessions. Thank you.